Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome to the Damage Report, everybody. I am John Iadarola. The Kavanaugh scandal just rolls on, getting worse every day. And according to what Michael Avenatti says, the next 48 hours are going to be really exciting, unless he doesn't actually come through. But Michael Avenatti would never overhype something. That's impossible. But we do have those updates on Kavanaugh for you on the show today. We also have Congressman Ro Khanna, who's going to be joining the show to break down the Stop Bezos Act, talk a little bit about corporate welfare and irresponsibility, the growing gap between corporate profits and the fate of their workers, and then much, much more. Donald Trump gave a big UN speech. I hear it was a side splitter. So we'll be breaking that down as well. Joining me to do that, Michael Shore is in studio.
Good to be here, John. News. Good to be back on the Damage Report.
Good to have
and,
you here,
and
as always.
And it's an hour later, which makes everybody happy in my house.
Yeah, it's a little bit easier in the mornings.
Yeah,
so yeah, I was able to snooze 7 times instead of 3, thanks to that new time. But as I alluded to, so much to get to, why don't we jump right into Kavanaugh? Because we have the congressman coming up in just a little bit, and there's so much on Kavanaugh. So he had an interview with Fox News. I'm sure you saw portions of that.
I did, yeah.
It was interesting. He had some new, I guess, defenses that I never knew were defenses against claims of sexual assault, but we'll be breaking those down. So we have a few videos for you. In this first one, he very strongly rejects all of the accusations against him.
I have never had any sexual or physical activity with Dr. Ford. I've never sexually assaulted anyone in high school or otherwise.
So where do you think this is coming from? Why would she make this up?
What I know is the truth, and the truth is I've never sexually assaulted anyone in high school or otherwise. I am not questioning and have not questioned that perhaps Dr. Ford at some point in her life was sexually assaulted by someone in some place. But what I know is I've never sexually assaulted anyone in high school or at any time.
So when she says there's no doubt in her mind that it was you. Because she was asked that. Is it possible that you maybe confused him? Maybe it's mistaken identity. Maybe it was someone else. She said, absolutely not.
I have never sexually assaulted anyone. I was not at the party described. I was not anywhere at any place resembling that in the summer of 1982. The other people alleged to be there don't say anything like that. And the woman who's alleged to be there, who's her friend, says that she doesn't know me and doesn't recall ever being at a party with me in her life.
So obviously it's interesting to break down the questions that people answer in these situations. It's also interesting to speculate as to why they won't answer certain questions. And I thought that you saw there something that came up multiple times throughout the course of the interview, which was a question to the effect of why would she or Deborah Ramirez or other people be making this up? And he instantly pivots back to, I never sexually assaulted anyone. If that's true, I understand why he would want to reiterate that message. But since the main defense out there coming from, I mean, Donald Trump, even today after his UN speech was saying that these women are lying, it's a smear job, it's a coordinated campaign. Brett Kavanaugh had said that in his letter recently. They're claiming that these are untrue allegations, but they cannot actually make a case as to why the women would all be lying. And not just lying about the sexual assault, but lying in ways that you would not lie if it was made up. You would not say, he tried to rape me, and also this particular individual was in the room with me.
Right.
All of these things that could be investigated, and obviously would be investigated if you made a claim like this, they're very suspiciously detailed and verifiable, or, you know, able to be shot down, lies in that case. And so he's not even trying to make a case as to why those women would all of a sudden be lying about it.
Well, that's a big part of it. And that's what's going to be really difficult on Thursday when he testifies before the Senate, because the notion that anybody would make this up to come forward to stop a judicial nominee out of the clear blue, it's really, really hard to fathom that. She's gotten death threats. I'm talking about Blasey Ford, death threats. Her family's been threatened. There's no way that you would volunteer this. And she almost did it grudgingly because of those facts.
Yeah.
And so it makes her story, the believability of her story, at least more compelling than it would if it were just, you know, if it was a matter of fact thing that she did off the cuff.
And I think before we go back to more of the clips, there's, I think, a very important point about America and especially about men on the right that, that needs to be said is that we know from the statistics what percentage of these accusations are false. It's like 1 to 3% or something like that. I mean, those are difficult numbers to come up with because, of course, many people don't actually make the accusations at all, even though the actual act happened. But whatever, it's a very small percentage point. But and we're supposed to pretend as if men on the right accept that. But they don't accept that. They clearly think that most of these accusations are false. Certainly, any accusation against a powerful or influential man does not have a 1% chance of being false or a 3% chance of being false. They assume that the woman is lying. So they seem to think that a greater than 50% chance that these women are lying. That is why they're able to push this theory that this is a coordinated campaign where all of these women have decided to upend their lives without actually having to make the case as to why that is. Because they know that when Rush Limbaugh says that they're lying, which just happened today, and I think Donald Trump retweeted it or tweeted out a comment about it, they just state it as fact and they know that their predominantly male viewership will accept it without any extra evidence.
Yeah, but I think when you're talking about the viewership, I personally don't think the Senate has the votes to confirm Kavanaugh right now.
You don't think so? I mean, even Manchin, as of yesterday, was talking about the possibility of voting for him.
I don't think they have the votes. I don't. And the reason I don't is because Mitch McConnell wants to hurry the vote. Mm-hmm. And you do those things when you don't think you have the votes to try and awaken the people who might not. So while I agree with you that these people are so easily convinced that somebody's lying, at least the 50, you were talking about more than 50%, at least the 51 that they need to get in the Senate, I don't believe they have right now. So somebody is listening to what she has to say. And, you know, I think on Thursday a lot of minds will be made up, too, after they see the testimony.
So you still think Thursday is going to happen?
I do think Thursday is going to happen.
Even if the Avenatti in the next day or two?
With what I know today, I think it's going to happen. Hypothetically, you know, whatever, a water balloon could drop. I don't know.
Okay, so Michael Shore, like Brett Kavanaugh, will not answer hypotheticals.
I won't answer any hypotheticals. But there's a real, I mean, the political side of this. Mitch McConnell's forcing this vote to get senators like Joe Manchin, who are in tight races, though his is not so tight, but Heidi Heitkamp and Claire McCaskill and Joe Donnelly and John Tester on the record on this so that they can use that as a midterm ploy. He's afraid of losing the Senate, and this is he's a great politician. I whatever you want to say about him,
I could
sit here for a long time, but he's great at his job, you know, in terms of doing these sorts of the Senate maneuvering the same way Harry Reid was and other people before. But I mean, you know my feelings about Mitch McConnell. But in terms of like what a tactician he is, it's proven to be pretty good. I think that's why this is happening. I think that's why the vote's being rushed, because they don't think that they have the votes. So that's why Kavanaugh is doing and his handlers are doing this offensive to try and get to change that opinion.
Interesting. And you think that strategy both remains a good strategy, even though Kavanaugh is apparently like the least popular Supreme Court nominee?
I don't know that it's – I think it's a terrible strategy. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that that's the political tactician side here. He wants to get these people – his calculation is that by voting against a conservative Supreme Court nominee, the Republican Senate Campaign Committee can go to Montana and scream at John Tester for doing that. Mm-hmm. You're anti-conservative. You don't want – you're pro-whatever. You're anti-this. That gives him something. He doesn't care about the bench. He'll get his conservative judge in his mind. Of course, he might have a Democratic Senate at that point. Mm-hmm. That's what he wants to avoid.
Yeah, and he'll still, even if there is going to be a Democratic Senate, there's still that period between Election Day and when the senators are actually sworn in.
There is. To get that done in the Merrick Garland way, there's no way the Democrats at that time are probably going to be able to. I mean, I don't see them agreeing to a committee. I think other senators on the Republican side will be the same. That's not to say that there won't be a conservative justice who's nominated by this president who's going to be approved by a Democratic Senate either. I mean, that's going to happen. It's just this short list might have to get a little longer.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an unfortunate truth and a reminder. Bear that in mind during the next election. Presidents get to choose Supreme Court justices.
It's
unfortunate. For life, yes, and for a very long time. And you never know how many they're actually going to get. We don't have quite enough time in this block to get to the next video. But I do want to mention, so they have that strategy. Obviously, they're focusing on putting pressure on these Democrats in red states by making them go against a conservative judge. I always wonder how much that would actually impact a vote. But in doing that, they are willing to make very clear what they think about sexual assault in general and basically respect for women and whether they're telling the truth. And maybe they're not acknowledging that, or maybe they just think that they've bottomed out with support and the women that still support them are never going to turn on them regardless of what they say or do. But they are making very clear to a significant chunk of the population, something like 51%, exactly what they think about them. So that's a questionable
tactic. And a higher percentage of the voting population too, which is important. And it's not about the votes. It's not about what this will do to a vote. It's what it lets the Republican campaign arms do.
Yeah.
Make ads, go after these people.
So. That's true. Okay, so there you have basically the strategy. In a little bit, we are going to return to this topic and we're going to break down some more of Kavanaugh's attempts to defend himself that almost comedically quickly are shredded by other people around at the time that can attest to his actual character. So that is certainly going to be fun. And a little preview of one of the possibly underhanded tactics that the GOP is going to take into the hearing on Thursday that you should be prepared for. But when we come back from this break, Congressman Ro Khanna is going to be joining us. We're going to be talking about Amazon, the Stop Bezos Act, corporate welfare, and more. Over the past couple of years, Amazon has absolutely exploded, now being valued at more than $1 trillion at a time when some of its employees still need to pee into bottles on their breaks and many are on various government programs because of low wages. That's an interesting dichotomy there. And now some politicians are attempting to do something about it, like Bernie Sanders in the Senate and also Ro Khanna in Congress, who joins us now on the Damage Report. Ro Khanna, welcome to the show.
John, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. So I want to talk about the Stop Bezos Act in the Senate and also your Corporate Responsibility and Taxpayer Protection Act that you put forward last summer, seeking to address this large and apparently growing gap between the success of corporations and the success of its workforce. So these bills, what are they hoping to accomplish?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Well, it's common sense. If you go work at a company that is worth billions of dollars, the company should be able to pay you a wage so that you don't have to rely on food stamps. And yet we have these cases of multi-billion dollar corporations, in some cases trillion dollar corporations, paying their employees so little that those employees are still having to rely on public benefits. What this bill says is the corporations are going to be held liable for those public benefits if they're not paying a $15 minimum wage.
Now, of course, in the naming of the bill, there's, you know, Bezos is in the name of the Senate version of this bill. Obviously, this might be the most egregious case, but why the focus specifically on Amazon?
Well, Amazon, the day we had announced, issued a $1 trillion market cap or release. And so it was just this disparity that here they're a company worth $1 trillion, and yet they have employees who are making $10, $11 an hour. And singling him out was not for criticism. It was to say, look at Henry Ford's model. I mean, Henry Ford paid people $2.50 a day and then doubled those wages to $5 a day in 1914. By the way, $5 a day back then is about $120 a day today, which is $15 an hour. If Henry Ford could do it, why can't Bezos and some of these other leaders who are sitting on top of huge corporations do the same thing?
Congressman, it's Michael Schur. Question for you. We last saw each other in Stat Hall about a month ago. My question going on to what John said about Jeff Bezos, you represent Silicon Valley. I mean, you represent an industry that, while Amazon is not a big part of that there, certainly the Amazon culture and the Amazon way has been something that's given rise to Silicon Valley's success. How difficult is this politically to take somebody like Jeff Bezos, who also owns the Washington Post now and has been, you know, a part of saving journalism in a way? How difficult politically is this for you?
Well, it's not popular. As you saw, a lot of people criticized the bill when it was out in the Beltway. People outside the Beltway love it. And Amazon, of course, has offices in my district. But what I say is very simple. I respect Jeff Bezos as an entrepreneur. I respect the innovation. My wife and I buy Amazon packages. But what we're calling for is not ending innovation or ending a technology in any way. What we're saying is make sure everyone is benefiting from innovation and technology. Make sure that if you're making billions of dollars, other people are at least making a livable wage. And this seems to me actually in the enlightened self-interest of tech companies to prevent a backlash against what they're doing.
You know, we've talked in a few areas about you know, like subsidizing of dirty oil, like oil companies, coal companies, things like that. The U.S. government is fairly generous when it comes to that sort of welfare programs for these incredibly profitable corporations. It seems to me that while you said that politically it might be difficult to put forward a bill like this, and it's been pitched as sort of a left-wing thing, I don't really know why Republicans or conservatives around the country would be satisfied or happy with a situation where effectively the U.S. government is subsidizing Amazon or any of these large corporations that depend on federal programs to allow the workforce simply to survive and allow Amazon to get away with not paying them more. Do you see this as an inherently bipartisan sort of bill that could cross, you know, between liberals and conservatives in terms of appealing to their desire for the corporations to be more responsible and less dependent on government?
I do, John. In fact, I was on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News, and to my surprise, he really liked the bill because he said it's ridiculous that taxpayers are subsidizing multi-billion dollar corporations. Now, some of the people in the Beltway took that and said Sanders and Khanna are demonizing public benefits. Of course we're not. Of course we believe in public benefits. Senator Sanders has been a champion for expanding Social Security and standing up for public benefits, and I have supported public benefits. But what I don't believe in is that when you have corporations that have extraordinary gains, and all of those gains are going to a closely held group of executives, that taxpayers should then be paying public benefits. So what this bill is intended to do is getting multi-billion dollar corporations to pony up so that taxpayers aren't stuck with the bill. And I think it has broad support, conservatives and Democrats, outside the Beltway. Inside the Beltway, where the lobbyists have loud voices and Amazon and other companies have loud voices, there has been criticism.
Yeah, and hopefully, I mean, maybe one good thing that came out of the 2016 election is that clearly, with the success of Donald Trump in his rhetoric, if not in his actions, he made clear that there are a lot of Americans that feel like these corporations have been getting away with murder for a very long time. And they might be more awakened, not necessarily along traditional party lines, to be more responsive to bills that might seek to address that. Hopefully in the next election, that can be a bigger portion of it.
This is what Democrats missed. I mean, we have to speak to what real people are facing in many parts of this country. And they're facing stagnant wages without good job opportunities. We have to answer the question, what are we going to do for them? Obviously, Donald Trump promised them policies that are wrong, increasing tariffs and stopping immigration. But he promised them something, wrong as it was. We have to say, no, a better approach is to make sure these companies are paying a decent wage and making sure that the government will be providing a raise through the earned income tax credit for workers who are working hard. So we really need to speak to people's actual concerns.
I couldn't agree more. So I did want to ask you also about the story that's, I think, legitimately and should dominate the news cycle this week, and that is the continuing hearing process for Brett Kavanaugh. As more and more of these accusations are coming out, we're expecting that more will develop before Thursday's hearing. Unfortunately, you are not allowed, you're not going to be a part of the hearing, unfortunately, because you're not in the Senate. But what do you think needs to happen as this hearing goes forward in terms of should there be an investigation? What should happen with his nomination process?
Well, there certainly should be an investigation, and the victims who are coming forward should be treated with respect and seriousness and not be subject to a circus. But I'm just surprised that there hasn't been a call for Kavanaugh to withdraw. I mean, this is not a court of law where you have to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. There are only 9 people who get to serve on the Supreme Court. It's an extraordinary honor. And given the questions that have come up now, not just in one case, but in multiple cases, one would think that we could have someone else filling that role. Again, no one is saying that he should be locked up. This is not a beyond a reasonable of the doubt or preponderance of the evidence standard. This is a question of, is this person fit to be on the highest court of the land?
And following up quickly, Congressman, when you look at the politics of this, do you understand a little bit why they have not asked him to withdraw, why Mitch McConnell is pushing a vote as soon as possible on this? I sense, and whenever I hear that, having covered it for a while, I sort of think they really think that they're in bad shape here. In order to get people on the record very quickly in an election year, I feel like that's why he's doing it. John and I were just discussing that. Do you see some merit to that?
Well, I think they're thinking tactically and not strategically. Tactically, they're thinking what is going to get their base out, because they know that Trump is stuck in the low 40s. They need their base to turn out to salvage a terrible midterm election. And they feel like if they don't get a vote for Kavanaugh, their base isn't going to turn out. Strategically, they're losing a lot of thoughtful independence in suburban America and other parts of America. And this is horrible for the long-term brand of the Republican Party and what they stand for when it comes to basic decency and basic women's rights. And so I think they're willing to sacrifice that long-term brand for short-term tactics of getting their base out.
I, again, couldn't agree more. Representative Ro Khanna, thank you so much for joining the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, much more to get to on Brett Kavanaugh. More video from his Fox News interview. He's got a few ideas that he thinks are defenses of his behavior. We'll break it down after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report. Michael Shore is in studio. I guess I'm here too. And we're going to talk some more about Kavanaugh. So he had his Fox News interview. I want to play a little bit more of a tape where he talks about one of his main strategies, his main defenses, not just now, but it's been throughout the process, ever since the first allegations came out, is that his reputation is impeccable, and people can attest to the fact that he would never do these sorts of things. He will go into detail on that.
And 65 girls agreed.
Originally, yes. Yes, very quickly agreed, oddly enough, right after the first accusations. Guys, if you don't already have your letter of 65 women you haven't sexually assaulted, you should really get on that, right, just in case.
Who like knew a will. 65? Did you know 65 girls in high school?
I don't know that I've ever known, no, really known 65 girls.
Right, that could attest to your character.
Yeah, or would care to. Right. In any event, here's Brett Kavanaugh.
Deborah Ramirez was a freshman at Yale. She says she was at a dorm party and this happened. Quote, Brett was laughing. I can still see his face and his hips coming forward like when you pull up your pants. I'm confident about the pants coming up and I'm confident about Brett being there. She was initially uncertain it was you, they write in this piece, but after 6 days, she's confident enough, she says. Should the American people view her as credible?
I never did any such thing. Never did any such thing. The other people alleged to be there don't recall any such thing. If such a thing had happened, it would have been the talk of campus. The women I knew in college and the men I knew in college says it's inconceivable that I could have done such a thing.
Okay, so he made 3 claims there. All 3 claims are wrong. So first he says the people that were there say that it didn't happen. There are multiple witnesses from that particular event at Yale that say that they either witnessed it or that they were told about it. One man said that he overheard a woman talking about it that night, who's incredibly specific about who had been involved in it. So that's not true. It not being the talk of the campus, it was the talk of campus, people were talking about it. And they continued to talk about it up until the beginning of this year when apparently emails were going around of people who have never forgotten about that incident and continue to talk about it. The third being that people who knew him then can attest to that he would never do this sort of thing. Unfortunately, the same day as that interview, James Roche, who is Kavanaugh's Yale roommate, had an interview where he said this. I concluded that although Brett was normally reserved, he was a notably heavy drinker, even by the standards of the time, and that he became aggressive and belligerent when he was very drunk. I did not observe the specific incident in question, but I do remember Brett frequently drinking excessively and becoming incoherently drunk. So he says in another part of the interview, you know, there are beers and, you know, we drink, but never to excess, nothing crazy ever happened. Well, the guy that lived with him said, no, he becomes aggressive and belligerent and incoherently drunk.
Yeah,
that's your character witness right there. And so that's 3 points.
And that's his roommate. I mean, that's not just a kid, that was in his Spanish class at Yale. That's his roommate.
Would have seen him stumble into the room and things like that. Like, I had a roommate freshman year. I think we called him Boozy Ben. I probably shouldn't have said his real name. Anyway, I had a lot of roommates through the course of college.
You didn't say his last
name. No, I didn't.
I had a roommate named Mark Easley. We called him Mark.
Really? Clever. And he would get drunk constantly. Like, I have other friends that I'm still friends with, that I could tell you things about how drunk they used to get. And when you live with these people and you spend time with them, you do get to understand how they are when they're partying. And so we have more that we're going to get to. But my overall thing is, I think that we all, as not just in what we heard from the witnesses in terms of what he was like, but his yearbook page, the Mark Judge's book, like, it paints a very persistent, from their own words, history of what they were like. And I think that we all knew people like that in college or in prep school or whatever. I didn't go to Georgetown Prep or anything like that, but I know an entitled elitist a-hole when I see one.
Yeah.
People who wanted to go crazy knew that there would be no consequences for what they did. And then they want to put on a tie and suddenly become quite reputable. And I would never have done anything like that. I was focused on academics and athletics and being friends with girls and things like that. Well, you're bragging in your yearbook page about your keg club. And we've got more that we're going to get to.
Have you done the Renata alumni
stuff? Yeah, we can actually. Why don't we bring that up? Yeah. So we'll push back Mark Judge talking about Bart O'Kavanaugh throwing up in a car. So Renata Schroeder. A bunch of the guys in the yearbook had references to the Renat Alumni Club, which she found out about. Now, understand that she had been one of the women who wrote the letter saying that they defended him. Well, when she signed the September 14th letter, she wasn't aware of the Renat Alumnus yearbook references on the pages of Judge Kavanaugh and his football teammates. She says, I learned about these yearbook pages only a few days ago. I don't know what Renat Alumnus actually means. I can't begin to comprehend what goes through the minds of 17-year-old boys who write such things, but the insinuation is horrible, hurtful, and simply untrue. I pray their daughters are never treated this way. So she seems to think that it is a reference to these guys having hooked up with her and bragging about it publicly. Turns out it's not that. A member of Kavanaugh's growing legal team told the Times that the inside joke was simply a reference to a single high school event that the two attended together, during which they shared a brief kiss goodnight. Yes, that's what he was referencing in his yearbook, and all of them did.
Right.
They all had a peck on the cheek, and they were simply giving a tip of the hat to each other in the yearbook.
It wasn't just Kavanaugh who had Renata alumni.
Yeah, was it 12 or 14?
I think it was 12. I remember 12. It may have been 14, but I was drunk. That implies that this was a talked about thing by people who were there doing this kind of by people that were like him.
Yeah.
And it speaks to his character. And people say, well, it was high school. People then say, well, it was college. That he's going for the Supreme Court, right? He's not going for a job working even at an accounting firm or running for alderman, right? He's going for the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
That stuff does matter.
And that speech in 2015, he was still talking like, you know, we used to say what happens at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep. Oh, God, I better strip that out of the transcript I give to the Senate. I don't want them to actually know about that. But he was clearly looking back on that as a formative, awesome time in his life. Perhaps we, too, can look back on it and assume that it still has something to say about the type of person that he is. There's one more video I want to show. This is one of the most interesting defenses that he puts forward. Now, this is in reference to a question about the Deborah Ramirez allegation. Oh, no, I think this one is actually So Michael Avenatti is coming forward and saying that there's these claims that there had been these trains on girls that were being plied with alcohol into incoherence. And the possibility that he might have been involved in one of those, and here is his response.
That's totally false and outrageous. Never done any such thing, known about any such thing. When I was in high school, and I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, a Jesuit high school, where I was focused on academics and athletics, going to church every Sunday at Little Flower, working on my service projects, and friendship. Friendship with my fellow classmates and friendship with girls from the local all-girls Catholic schools. And yes, there were parties. And the drinking age was 18. And yes, the seniors were legal and had beer there. And yes, people might have had too many beers on occasion. And people generally in high school, I think all of us have probably done things we look back on in high school and regret or cringe a bit. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an allegation of sexual assault. I've never sexually assaulted anyone. I did not have sexual intercourse or anything close to sexual intercourse in high school or for many years thereafter.
Some follow-up questions where they go into, man, this guy did not get laid forever, basically.
Right.
And so look, it's not as cut and dried as some people were making out to be yesterday where, did you sexually assault this person? I couldn't have. I'm a virgin. But it's also not as uncut and dried as the people that point that out on Mediaite and things like that, saying people are claiming that's his defense. It's not his only defense, but he does present it as a defense.
Right.
That these claims about his sexual assaults can't be true because he wasn't actually getting it on for a while. He can have done everything except for perhaps the gang rapes. He could have put his penis in someone's face. He could have tried to rape them during a party in high school and still have been a virgin. After all, it was not a successful sexual assault. But
right.
It is
also, it's almost more incriminating, right? Somebody who's so desperate or so, you know, who hasn't been, you know, sophisticated in that realm of life. Would be more inclined to be the person who does something like he's alleged to have done. I mean, there's that argument as well.
Perhaps, yes. I would say that the most true thing about this is, I don't care when you say you lost your virginity. The entire thing that we're talking about is a claim that you are a persistent liar, that you lie about when you get access to certain documents. You lied about talking with George W. Bush and his team about enhanced interrogation, up to it including lying about your sexual assault. So at that point, I don't care if you say that you got laid at 2 or 12 or 35. What's the difference? That has nothing to do with anything.
Well, and the other thing here is none of this is under oath. Under oath, he's already lied about those documents.
Yes.
So that is the most incriminating. Before we ever knew the name Christine Blasey Ford, he was a guy who, before a Senate committee, lied about the documents.
Yeah. So look, overall, I want you to understand all of these different aspects of the story because it's important and it is complicated. There's so many different aspects to it. The most important takeaway from all of this, though, is that his core defense that I have an unimpeachable reputation, something that Donald Trump continues to repeat until today, becomes less true and indeed more laughable with every new detail. Both from what others have said about him, what he has said about himself throughout his life, he does not have an impeachable reputation. He has a reputation, that's for sure, but it's not one that I think necessarily should help him during this process. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We come back, one more thing on this, and then we get to the UN speech. Donald Trump goes before world leaders, and it ends pretty much like you'd think it would. Okay, so there's one more thing that you should know about the hearing that is, as of right now, still scheduled for Thursday. There's going to be testimony of both Christine Blasey Ford, but there will be one other person at the hearing, and that is an experienced sex crimes prosecutor that the GOP is bringing in to question Christine Blasey Ford. Her legal team put out a letter saying, this is not a criminal trial for which the involvement of an experienced sex crimes prosecutor would be appropriate. Neither Dr. Blasey Ford nor Judge Kavanaugh is on trial. The goal should be to develop the relevant facts, not try a case. But they are bringing someone in.
And Lindsey Graham has said that that person is going to be asking all the questions of the Republican senators on behalf of the Republican senators at this. I can't see how it's going to make this whole sort of panel of Republican men. There's not a woman on that Judiciary Committee who's a Republican. There are four on the Democratic side. There were none when Anita Hill in 1991 came to testify on the Clarence Thomas nomination. I can't see how this is a successful optic for the Republicans.
Well, I th- I mean, at least in an immediate sense, I think their idea is that they want to shred this woman.
Yeah.
But they want to put these right. old white men's words in the words of what is almost certainly going to be a woman.
They don't want it to be them doing it. They don't like that. But it's yeah. just going to seem awkward to see them sitting silently while this person grills them and they're not stepping in at all. I understand they're in a tough spot, honestly. Like, it's a tough place. If they grill her, they look awful. If they don't. Then they'll look awful.
Yeah, so I think in response, there's going to be a lot of the onus is going to be on Democratic senators to deal with that and to make sure that Kavanaugh also is grilled. And right. I think Kamala Harris, I'm looking at you. She needs to put her hand on her head and she needs to ask him some tough questions. We know that she can do it. Okay, with that, why don't we move on? The world was watching as Donald Trump went before the UN to represent our country and what is best in it and address them. So we have a couple of excerpts from his speech that we're going to break down. The first, though, I want to show you the very beginning of his speech and how it was received from all of the dignitaries as he was announcing the success of America.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
And I would say I've seen him get bad responses before. I think he handled it okay for him.
Yeah, he did.
Although there was a little bit after the initial smiling and the joke about not expecting that response. This is the sort of thing that for someone with a fairly severe narcissistic personality disorder like Donald Trump, I'm shocked that missiles aren't in the air right now, launched at Luxembourg or something like that.
Well, it's also the president spoke before the United Nations General Assembly, and this is what people are going to remember. You know, what he said afterwards about the Koreas, what he said about Syria. I mean, he set a real line in the sand on Syria, saying that, if Assad uses chemical weapons, we are going in. You know, I mean, he said strong stuff. But this is what people are going to remember because this is the president we have.
Yeah, we've just become so normalized to the constant exaggeration. And look, exaggeration in rhetoric is the 500th. Most significant thing that Donald Trump has done. It doesn't even merit real discussion, I guess. But I am just sick of it, that everything is the worst we've ever seen. We've never seen anything like it. It's more than people have ever talked about. And that room at the UN had hundreds and hundreds of people from around the world in it. All of them experienced in these sorts of things. These are people who are well-educated, well-traveled, have tons of life experience, and they're being talked to by one of the dullest, dimmest people in our country. That is ridiculous at a time when America needs to be not just involved in world affairs, but helping to lead the response to things like climate change. We need to have one of our best. And instead, we have this person. I wouldn't trust him to scoop ice cream at Baskin Robbins. And he's representing the country in front of every other country in the world.
And what's cool about the moment when they laughed was there's this delay because they're all wearing headphones at their translator. So it's being translated into, Burmese and Vietnamese and Spanish. And there's this delay. And then they all laugh together as soon as their translators are done.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay, so more serious, though. I want to turn back to America. And I just want to briefly mention an update to a story that we talked about previously. So Detroit has an absolutely horrible problem with lead and other forms of contamination in their water in their schools. So last month, when we initially talked about this, the school had turned off drinking water inside of all of their school buildings after some of the schools showed high levels of copper and lead. At that point, 16 of 24 schools had reported elevated levels, leading to what seemed to me like a pretty drastic step to literally turn off all the drinking water. I saw very little conversation about it. I know CNN reported on it, at least in written form, but that is a huge step to take. Well, now there's results of more than 100 schools in Detroit's public schools community district. Of the 86 schools whose test results have been released, 57 of them, or two-thirds, have elevated levels of copper and lead. So the initial fears that led to that water being turned off, they were right to do so, because this is not a small thing. This isn't some random pop-up test result. It's all over Detroit schools. And the problem is that while the short-term fix is turning off the water, that doesn't actually get the copper or the lead out of it. And there's no quick fix to this. Even the plans that they were talking about that we reported on a month ago to eventually replace these lines, we're talking about years and years. There are kids that haven't even entered the school system yet that will go through the entirety of their school program before those pipes are actually lead and copper free. And the only solution right now is to shut down the plumbing. Again, in America. I mean, how much money did we just throw at the military last week? How much money did we give to the 1% in corporations in that big tax bill earlier this year? In the meantime, you better bring Dasani into school with you if you're in kindergarten in Detroit. Absolutely horrid. And not nearly enough talked about. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. It's a special day in America, National Voter Registration Day. And we've got a really awesome app that expedites the process of registering that we're going to profile after we come back from this. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Not much time left. Did you know that today is National Voter Registration Day? It comes around so fast every year.
Every year.
But now it's here.
And it's always on a Tuesday.
It's always on a Tuesday. Weird how that works out. So this is one of the holidays every year where you have both an opportunity and an obligation as a citizen and hopefully one who cares about the future of your country. And that is to register to vote. And we're going to talk about why it's so important to do that. But if you'd like to do that, and it's sometimes a little bit complicated because the situation and what you need to do is different, you know, state to state and all of that. We have an opportunity for you. And it was provided by Voto Latino working with Rock the Vote. They have a new app, Voter Pal, that makes it literally as simple as it could possibly be to register to vote. All you have to do is download the Voter Pal app. You're going to take a picture of the QR code on the back of your driver's license. That is going to auto-populate the form with all of the information that you need to be registered to vote. You print it out, you sign it, and you mail it out. They have done everything aside from licking the envelope. They've done all the work for you. And you send that out, and then you're going to be registered to vote. You don't have to go looking for all that information or remember things or figure it all out. It's all going to be there thanks to the Voter Pal app. And what you can do, hopefully, is while it's super important for you to register, we need a lot of people to register. So they're also starting a challenge where they want you to use this app, register to vote, and then record a video challenging three people that you know to do the same. You can post on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of that. And hopefully, if this spreads, we can not just have a good turnout, you know, a nice turnout for the midterms, but a record-breaking turnout that can radically reshape the direction of this country. That would be awesome.
Can you do it? Question I don't know if you know the answer to. It'll be on the app. If you're already registered to vote, can you go in there and challenge other people, even if you don't register through them?
Well, I would say that if you want to do that, I would post a video and say, you know, I am registered, but here is a way to make it even simpler for you than it was for me.
Right.
What I need you to do is to take the time to do this. This is so quick. You definitely have the time. In the time it takes to watch this video, you could be registered to vote and you could engage in that challenge, whether you've already registered or whether you're using VoterPal to do it. And so what I've been hearing a lot, it was in the promo for the Pod Save America video, the new series on HBO is, you know, everybody says it's the most important election. Well, I know we always say that, but this time it's true. It does seem true.
It always seems really important. It's the last one seemed it because of these two nominations, and now we're seeing because we've gotten these two, the Supreme Court nominations, now that we've gotten two. The last one may have been more important, but now that we look at the president, this one clearly more important.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, we don't get to relitigate 2016 as much as many people online would like to. But this year has been a reminder of how high the stakes are. I mean, we're right in the middle of this Kavanaugh. Like, do you want an accused sexual assaulter on the Supreme Court for the next few decades? We had the family separation crisis. Oh, no? Do you?
No.
Okay, you don't. Well, maybe we can do something about it if you register and if you reshape the Senate through your participation of those that you could help to get registered. And like I was saying, the family separation crisis. Like, we have had a demonstration of, in all of these different areas, tax policy, healthcare, with the repeal of parts of the ACA, they can get a lot done, even having not won the popular vote. And the reason Donald Trump has been able to do that is because he still controls the House and he still controls the Senate. And unless many people take part, get registered, and actually go out and vote and bring other people to vote, he will still have the House, he will still have the Senate, and he will still have all the power he needs to continue to put forward policies that I find absolutely reprehensible. But thankfully, this is a democracy, so there is something we can actually do about it. So hopefully you'll take part in that process. I just want to check in, because we've done this a few times over the course of these primaries. In terms of the generic congressional ballot, things look pretty good. How are you feeling overall?
I mean, being out there, I'm feeling overall pretty good. There's one race I was, you know, there are a couple of races that are starting to move toward Democrats. One race, Will Hurd, I was just down in Texas outside San Antonio with Will Hurd, a Republican congressman in a Democratic district. That one's going to be tough, but yeah. I'm seeing good things for Democrats.
Okay, well, hopefully that Texas success will translate over to a better work as well. Okay, thank you so much, Michael. Always good to have you coming over from I-24. Thank you for watching. We'll be back tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.